I'm Eric Garcetti. I'm mayor of Los Angeles.
I believe that it is America's cities that can breathe hope back into this sometimes fragile and even damaged democracy.
You know, we see in Los Angeles and other cities the true American spirit, which is one of generosity, one that embraces each other, and one where everybody belongs, especially our immigrants.
Hay gente que siempre quiera callarte. Hay gente que nos quiere en la oscuridad.
Welcome to LA Podcast. Let me say what day it is. November 26, 2018. We have a little bit of a different theme song this week, and I guess going forward. The song is called Are You Ready, Garcetti? We received an amount of money that we don't have to disclose to have this be our theme song for the foreseeable future. It's an urban beat anthem.
I mean, I am ready, as the committee that paid for this song said. I think Garcetti's ready, and I'm ready for Garcetti. So,
we did kind of say that right after the midterms is when this would heat up, the draft Garcetti campaign. Help me explain why this is. Someone who knows more than I do about like machine politics. Where does this come from? This kind of thing. Why is this happening?
I saw a Rolling Stone article, which is so relevant because Rolling Stone covers music.
Right.
Yes.
So
they also,
that's where I first saw this. And they also cover politics and now, and they cover political music.
I think, but the music, the merit of the music is stands on its own. Yes. They were probably reviewing it is what I, mm-hmm. what I originally thought.
Pitchfork, I think.
There's also on Pitchfork. But I, from what the story said, a person who wants to kind of draft him sent this email out to a bunch of people, not on behalf of the mayor, with this song, and forwarded it maybe also to Rolling Stone, that who also printed the email in its entirety.
Yeah, the whole thing to me had kind of
like a leaked email too, I want to say. That was probably forwarded to Rolling Stone.
But the leaked email said, share this like as far as you can.
As many people as possible.
It was kind of just like a printed press release. It was interesting in the sense, like, it seemed like the coverage of Trudeau in Canada, where it's like, you know, he used to be a rocker. Now he's going to be prime minister. And now it's like Garcetti. He's hip. He's cool. He's got this urban Latino beat anthem.
Yeah.
It's going to propel him to the highest office in the land.
He can like break dance.
Yeah, that's right.
He can. Remember?
Prove it. I've seen no evidence of this. I've seen him do the robot in a video where he billed himself as breakdancing.
This is LA Podcast. Continuing. So Thanksgiving week was this week, so we should do like a corny Thanksgiving premise instead of an LA story. I was thinking, what I want to ask you guys, what are you thankful for from this year that happened in LA? It could be like a policy change, just something that happened this past year that you are thankful for.
I'm thankful for the song we just heard personally.
No, you can't do that. You have to talk about a new thing.
That is a new, that's the probably the newest thing I could talk about. One of the things that I don't think I've mentioned on here before, but one of the things I'm very thankful for is the law that went into place at the beginning of this year that allowed pedestrians to walk on the flashing red.
Yep, that's big.
Yeah, that makes me very happy. I feel like I
say
get
what
to.
That, yeah, go into
yeah,
that.
Yeah, explain that for people who don't know. It wasn't
in California. It was against the law to cross the street once the don't walk hand had started flashing, even if there was a countdown timer saying you have 20 seconds before the light turns yellow.
And people are like, surely they didn't give out tickets for that. But they did.
Especially in Los Angeles.
Downtown.
They love to give out tickets for that. It was seen as kind of a way to crack down on, I don't know, just people being out in public and convince them that it would be better for them to be in a car where you are definitely not going to get ticketed if you run through even a red light. So the state legislature legalized that during last year's session. So it went into effect in January. And I get to say now it's November. We're safe. It's been in practice for almost a year. All of the law enforcement officials who said that was a slippery slope, they were right. I'm happy to say that pedestrians now will just take over the streets and wantonly cross at will. I'm one of them. And yeah, they just get to gloat about that one.
Did they start ticketing cars that encroach upon the crosswalk?
I think you more than anybody knows the answer to that is no. They have not started doing that.
So that's something next year to be thankful for when they
That would be something to be thankful for.
What's your thankful for, Alyssa?
Mine's similar, I guess. I thought about this a lot since you... Well, I mean, I don't want to say that I had a bad week. I had a great week because I got to go to some events and some happenings where I got to see a lot of people who are working towards this better future that we talk about a lot on this podcast. And I'm starting to see the part happening, especially kind of what Scott was talking about, where people are seeing themselves part of the solution. And this amazing Metro ad that I keep talking about that came out. Did you guys see it? A lot of people saw it on like the football game the other day, on the Rams game. And it's been airing and it's, you know, popping up, but there's lines in it that are like, you know, I'm choosing not to drive. I don't want to be a part of car culture. I'm a part of this movement. And I'm just seeing more people that are in the face of another dire climate report or because it's the city's allowing them to have more choices that fit with their lifestyle or because they're realizing it's easier and more fun. I'm just seeing the starting of the change starting to happen.
Yeah.
The starting of the change.
This is anecdotal, but I think comment sections have gotten better.
Oh, I'm thankful for that.
I mean, there are like...
That's a good metric, though.
There are still crazy people, but as many people that are on board with more housing and fewer cars and the good stuff that we
talked
about.
And that's what I was going to say. I like that the Metro ad specifically, which I'm very thankful for, is just, it's like we're part of the movement, join the movement. And it is more about that. It's not just about cars and gas and whatever, but it's about a more inclusive society that allows more access for more people. So I'm seeing it.
Yep. I didn't have an example at the time we started this segment. I realized, even though it was my idea. But I have kind of thought of one, and maybe you'll tell me this isn't really happening. It's a weird year because a lot of stuff I feel like was promised a year ago today that hasn't really come through. We haven't seen a lot of new homeless housing from HHH. We were promised an underground tunnel that ran out of rails a year ago that would be open now.
Well, it's going to be
under
open.
Under the Sepulveda Pass.
Isn't it going to be open next week for rides?
The
December 10th?
Yes.
The ride.
Yes.
Boring Company, the ride will be open.
So they will have something open, but I believe the entire 12-mile tunnel was supposed
to be
open.
It was supposed
to
be done,
And that hasn't happened. But what I think has, anecdotally, the thing that the policy change that has made a difference in LA in the past year is the number of ADUs that are getting built, accessory dwelling units.
That's a good one.
Those seem to be kind of popping up everywhere. Used to be against the law for you to add a granny unit to your property.
And people did it anyway.
Yes, but people did anyway. But now I think they're doing it more because it is legal. And in some cases, you can get actual money
from the county. Yeah,
the county will pay if you will house someone in it for a certain amount of time. They'll pay, I think, $5,000. We're doing it and we're converting the garage to a granny. I mean, it's gotten a lot easier. And I think people are doing it. And I think it'll make a difference in terms of how many people are able to be housed in the city. That was good. We each came up with something.
I came up with two things.
I mean, I just think, I mean, if you look at a year ago, I'll just do a quick like example of how you get around, right? And you maybe pulled up your app and you might choose to get in a Lyft car or something like that. And now you have, depending on what part of the city you're in, Or you could take the bus or take your Lyft car, whatever. You can take bikes and scooters, and you can even take two different kinds of electric bikes in parts of the city. Mm-hmm. One of which is like our own bike share is introducing electric bikes and expanding the system. So there are more choices, and that's a marked difference from a year ago. And that's a real thing that's happening. So I think that if you want to track changes, we need the infrastructure to catch up, but there are choices and people are using the choices.
Scooters weren't even on the map.
Right. A year ago. That was what I just wanted to reiterate.
So Scott, a few weeks ago, you floated potentially restarting your blog.
Yeah.
And you said, stay tuned. And I thought you'd just keep us, waiting for months, but you actually did a post.
I did.
You started a website to compete with LAwebsite.net.
That was the main motivating factor, I have to say.
And you got into turnout. Now is the time of year. Normally, usually like the day after the election, a lot of columns get written about how LA's turnout is reprehensible. There's a lot of finger wagging about like how can we expect to have a representative democracy if we don't show up to vote. Then over the next 3 weeks, the turnout percentage increases by a huge amount. Nobody corrects these columns. They just sit there on the internet forever. But you did one analyzing turnout in LA this midterm election.
Yeah, and I did it. I took a relatively positive standpoint about our voter turnout, which seems like it is headed to the highest number of ballots cast in a midterm year in LA County ever. So that is, to me, the big news. We have something like the information that I'm using is all from the registrar recorder's office. The current year is based on estimates that they've put up. Dean Logan, who is the registrar recorder.
Because there are still ballots coming in.
Yeah, he's been putting up updates on Twitter, though. So I used the tabulated number of ballots that they've already gone through, as well as their estimates of how many they think are still outstanding, to put together some estimates for where we probably will be by the time that the vote is certified in a couple weeks. So 3 million votes, 3 million ballots cast in LA County is we're already past the previous record, which was about 2.5 million in 1966.
Wow.
A long, long time ago. And actually the turnout for that election, which was the gubernatorial election between Ronald Reagan and Pat Brown.
Whoa.
Which Reagan crushed in his first election to statewide office in California. Turnout was over 80%. In LA County that year. So
because of all the celebrities going to vote for Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, undoubtedly. Actually, just because LA was a much wider and much more conservative place in 1966 than it has been probably at any time since. So for the next 50 years, really, midterm elections have seen declining turnout. We've never eclipsed that 2.5 million ballots mark. Until this year, when we really just absolutely crushed it. 3 million. So we're 500,000 votes above the previous record this year.
Wow. We think it's notable that this happened in a basically uncontested gubernatorial election.
There's been something. I'm not sure if you've been seeing this on Twitter, but there's been a thing in California electoral politics Twitter where some of the statewide journalists have been discussing something they've called the Kashkari line. So the Kashkari line is sort of like meant to represent. Neil Kashkari was the Republican candidate for governor who ran against Jerry Brown 4 years ago and lost by 19 points or something like that. I think he got maybe 41% of the vote. So the Kashkari line was kind of a tongue-in-cheek representation of the bare minimum level that a party, a major political party, could get in a California gubernatorial election. Yeah.
In baseball, it's the Mendoza line, which is a batting average of 200.
Right.
And below that signifies just abject failure.
And so here we are 4 years later, and John Cox is indeed below the cash car line.
Wow.
He's actually below 40% at this point. So yeah, basically an uncontested gubernatorial election. However, voters have, I think, really taken the lessons of 2016 to heart. 2016 was, of course, an almost like endless news cycle of electoral nastiness, where the voters really did not turn out to the polls. I think in the droves that would have been expected based on who the candidates were, who Donald Trump is, I should say. That was a relatively low turnout election, but it seems like voters have taken that and been like, wow, this is a really important thing to take to heart and get out and vote. To wit, the drop off from the presidential year to this midterm election that we're having this year is the smallest in LA County of any cycle since 1980.
Wow.
Of course, Reagan's first presidential election.
Yeah, he really brought him out.
How does he really get him? Yeah.
He really did.
I was having a conversation about this with a friend who's a reporter who went around talking in the close congressional districts, interviewed a lot of people. And his takeaway this cycle was that people were emboldened, like were disappointed with the incumbent Republican candidates because they didn't do town halls and they weren't present. And there were lots of like local issues that people were focused on that made them turn on the Republicans. And my theory was that it is just Trump. That's what drove this cycle. And I wish you had written this post before I had this argument, because I think it bolsters my point, which was there wasn't in LA County. There wasn't anything, a couple ballot measures statewide, but there wasn't anything for people to really get behind locally. Maybe the sheriff election, but that didn't exactly make headlines. I think it just became like voting, and this midterm election was a much bigger part of the news cycle than it was in 2014.
I think also there was a lot of soul searching done by, and this is kind of true nationally, but among the California Democratic Party, there was soul searching after the 2014 midterms, which had just abysmal turnout. I think you pointed out in our text chain that neither Alyssa nor I had voted.
I was not going to mention that. I would never bring something like that up.
But turnout was.
I had a baby. What were you guys doing?
I actually don't even remember.
If I had a baby, I'd be even more emboldened to like go vote and change, like affect the world that my baby is going to live in.
I'm pretty sure I voted.
In 2014, in LA County, the turnout for the midterm election was the general election was. It was like 33%. It was astonishingly low compared to the about 60% that we're probably going to hit this year. So that prompted some soul searching. Some changes were actually made to increase voter turnout. Bob Hertzberg, state senator from the Valley here, introduced a law that allowed voters to mail in their ballots or receive a ballot even if they hadn't registered to vote by mail. So everybody gets a vote by mail ballot now. We of course have made it so that California is now a same day registration state. So a lot of things that were designed to lower the barriers to voting, and I think it's great that the Democratic Party is taking that seriously. They, as far as state politicians are concerned, they really don't have to, right, because they're going to win anyway. So yeah. I think from a civic standpoint, it's very good that they're taking that seriously. And I think that there are probably more changes that we could do to make it easier for more and more people to turn out.
Cause there are going to be a lot of changes happening by 2020 that we can talk about now or later, how they're going to be eliminating some polling places in the hope that more people are going to be switching to voting by mail or voting early.
Oh,
is that the idea? They're going
to
be consolidating.
The lines were pretty long.
Well, I think the idea is they'll stay open longer. You know, you can go and vote early for like a week at like multiple places.
Oh,
you know what I mean?
Okay.
So it's like voting early
That's cool.
You won't have the long lines of election day. I mean, a lot of other places do this kind of voting early thing. And then the idea to get more people to vote by mail or early or whatever you want to call it, or that you could go up to a week or 10 days ahead of time and vote. And this is one idea that has worked in a lot of other places, but people worry about it in a place like LA because they feel like it's already hard enough to get places, or your polling place isn't close enough to you.
Seems
or something
like
that.
It would make it harder, to
go a little bit further or something like that. So these are some big changes that are happening. But I think if the goal is to get more people to vote earlier by mail, I mean, that's, or maybe by your phone by then, who knows? I don't think that'll happen by 2020. But if those are the changes that start to happen, that I'm on board for.
Yeah,
them,
that's great. Voting by mail rules. Where can people find this blog of yours, Scott?
It's very pretty, by the way. I just want to say
charts.
Yeah,
a lot better than our...
Your charts are real pretty.
Thank you. It is at imperishablepostla.wordpress.com.
The post will never go... The will never expire
never
on your
die.
Blog.
Yeah.
And you'll update them constantly.
What local blog do you think is perishable that you're comparing yours to?
I don't know, Ace. Do you have one in mind?
Isn't a podcast kind of perishable because it has a shelf life of really only a week?
No, actually, it's up there forever.
very, very probably my previous blog, Redline Reader, which has perished. So,
Okay, some updates on the campfire in Northern California. We're going to talk about some things, the local conversation, but the numbers of people that were declared dead from the fire did go up this week. It's now at 85, I believe. There was a moment where it seemed like the number was going to go up by a huge amount. Yeah. And it has not. At some point, there were over 1,000 people still missing.
Yep.
That number has gone down significantly to in the 200s. And it seems like it's going to continue to go down,
yep.
Which is a good thing that the numbers weren't as high as it seemed like they were going to be for a while. Was still an incredibly awful disaster, the deadliest fire in California history. It has affected the discourse locally in ways that we want to talk about. There was an article in the LA Times this week by Ron Lynn that referred to how difficult it was for people to get out of Paradise. There's basically one highway that leads out of the city, and lots of people were stuck on it in their cars in a very fast-moving fire. Local activists, let's say, who would like to build more roads and widen the roads and make it easier for cars to get around the city. You never let a tragedy go to waste.
Right.
And said that basically that Paradise shows that in LA, we can't do road diets. We need wider roads so that in the case of a natural disaster, people can get out of the city in their cars as quickly as possible. Alyssa, what were some of the things that you saw on the internet this week?
Just to go back to the argument by the activists, which is always about either first responders being able to get by on narrow lanes or something, mm-hmm. like trucks can never get by, or that LA is in a tsunami zone, a tsunami evacuation zone, and there are certain streets that need to be wide because we're all going to be escaping the tsunami in our vehicles, which we can revisit that later. But
it'll be too late by then. We'll be washed away.
Yeah, the entire
you're dragging
population.
Your feet, Alyssa. We're all going to wash out to sea.
Anyway, so this comes up every time there's any kind of improvement. During the Playa road diet conversation, it was all about tsunamis and, you know, if this gridlock is...
Calling it a conversation is very generous,
so
by the way.
Let's give a little context for this.
One-sided shouting.
This activist group that we're talking about is called Keep LA Moving. I would say that's the preeminent organization that is in favor of cars being able to go as fast as possible through the city. And they really sort of came into their own during the conversation over whether to impose a road diet in Playa del Rey. Council member Mike Bonin in the 11th district narrowed one of the main roads going through Playa del Rey, added bike lanes, He was threatened with a recall. There were tons of protests, lots of people screaming at him, to the point that he eventually removed the road diet.
Yeah, the actual, so the changes were made in response to a fatal collision. Somebody who had parked on one side of the road and was going across the street to Dockweiler State Beach and was hit and killed by a car. It's very often very foggy there, so they moved the parking to the other side of the road, reduced the number of lanes so that cars would not speed through that stretch. This has been shown to work.
And they did it before summer began because the idea was more people would be using the beach in the summer, and a lot of the deaths had occurred in the summer or in the warmer months.
Yeah, as we've frequently discussed, the impetus for this type of change to streetscape in LA is unfortunately that the city is trying to avoid financial liability, which is valid, but that is generally what it takes, is somebody to be killed or seriously injured, and then the action happens pretty immediately after that. In this case, it wasn't enough to stave off the I don't know, the populist uprising of Manhattan Beach millionaires who stormed the gates of the city of LA with their pitchforks and threatened to recall somebody who does not represent them successfully.
But it worked.
It worked.
Yes.
Although the recall campaign didn't work.
The recall campaign didn't work, but the effort to get the road diet removed did work.
Yeah, they changed it. So since we're talking about, this is, you know, the PCH, basically, what we're talking about. We're talking about Vista Del Mar, which is the road closest to the ocean, right? So just to, before we get into what happened in Paradise, we also had to evacuate a large part of Los Angeles County during the Woolsey Fire, right? And I don't know if anybody was watching, but Malibu, only a few ways out of Malibu, similar to Paradise. Think about it. Paradise actually has four routes in and out. One is a highway. So there were other routes that had been designated different evacuation routes, but some of them got blocked by power lines or trees that were on fire. But if you look at what happened in Malibu, we were evacuating a large number of people. I don't think as large as the population of Paradise in Malibu. I think Malibu is like 16,000 maybe. Okay.
But going into like West Hills, I'll bet I'm just saying from Malibu side.
Yeah, just from Malibu, because there was really only one way out, and they were telling people to evacuate towards Santa Monica. Did anybody watch the footage of people evacuating Malibu? Did you guys see
that? I haven't seen it.
Okay, so for a while they let people go on two lanes of the PCH. There's four lanes on the PCH. And then eventually they let all four lanes become southbound traffic to your south, you know, whatever you want to say. Malibu's crooked. But southbound traffic into Santa Monica. They were not just letting the cars go as fast as they possibly could down the PCH. There were two cruiser cars, police cruisers, in the front, kind of weaving back and forth, doing that slow down, guys. Wow. Don't go super fast, because you can't just let people drive as fast as they possibly can to evacuate. And they were making sure people weren't trying to go around on the shoulder, as you know, a lot of people are going to try to do. So there's a great deal of traffic management that does happen in an evacuation setting. And we got to see exactly what happens. They're monitoring it. They're making sure cars are moving. And they're, you know, making sure that people are safe driving out of there, too, because you can't just have people going like 80 miles an hour. So the other thing I just wanted to highlight is that if you were going to design the perfect evacuation route to get people, to get 16,000 people out of Malibu or whatever, you would design a 20-lane freeway that would be going down the middle of your city to get people out. I'm not sure that we are designing for evacuation of natural disasters in, you know, our infrastructure. That's not what we're thinking about first and foremost all the time. Because also, if it's an earthquake and it busts up the road, how is that going to serve you at all if you have this, you know, have no way to get out? So the way that we need to be thinking about evacuation is multiple routes and not only in cars.
Not only in cars is crucial.
Yeah. And you don't, because you don't have time to get 16,000 cars.
Panicking people are like dangerous enough when they're on foot. Like the measure that you described with the cop car driving in front of them to make sure that they're not driving through one another is indicative of how much more dangerous it is when you have thousands of cars trying to leave a crowded place at once. People start to panic, and there's very little that you can do to safely panic when you're driving. So I think that's absolutely key. I also want to point out that this ridiculous outrage from Keep LA Moving of saying like the road diet is a contributing factor to the number of people who died in the campfire up north. When the conversations around road diets were taking place here in LA, those same people were saying that they were not going to be guilted into thinking about the people that were actually routinely being killed on LA's streets, that it was irrelevant that somebody had been hit by a car and killed. And that's why the street should be made safer, should be designed in a better way that is more in keeping with known standards that protect lives. They were saying that that was just like a tactic to distract people from the standard conditions of operating the road. Of course, now they want us to act like all of LA is burning down all the time. And that's the reason why we need to just turn everything into a 10-lane freeway. Not where they live, of course, yeah, but like, you know, where they drive through. So it's a remarkable double standard. I think that's not unexpected, but it is noteworthy, I guess.
Some people do want it happening where they live. Alyssa flagged a post on Nextdoor, always a good resource for reasoned debate, right, in LA or any other neighborhood. And the subject is evacuation plan. And it says, reading about the Paradise, California gridlock as families tried to evacuate during the fires, I'm wondering if Silver Lake has an emergency evacuation plan in place. We are in a high fire zone, and like Paradise, we have also reduced 4-lane streets to 2 lanes, adding to the peak traffic hours gridlock. You know, but probably referring to the Rowena, yep, road diet, which added a couple of non-protected bike lanes, basically suggesting that in the case of a fire emergency, people that are trying to leave the city will like be racing to get out in their cars and say like, oh God, I wish I could use that bike lane, but no, I must respect the marked lane. I will not drive across it. You can just see this being added to the arsenal,
oh, yeah,
of in the debate to try and widen roads, make the city better for cars.
This is the dream. And I'm a little disappointed in this LA Times article because it only talked to the mayor of the city, who, God, has a lot of other things to deal with and had to talk about how they made these changes to protect the people that lived in the city. Yeah. She said that, people had been killed on this road, and that's why they made these changes. And also because the businesses were complaining that people didn't feel safe walking around and shopping, and that they wanted to give people a reason to stick around and safely cross the street. Same reason that a lot of neighborhoods want these same, you know, changes brought to their own central business districts. And then the only other person quoted in the article was the chief of police in the city, who said that there were many different ways they had to get people around traffic, including, as other stories have reported, that there were down power lines and burning trees in the way. So you can't clear every single, you know, roadblock that's going to be stopping people from getting around. But the thing that struck me the most in reading a lot of these stories is the problem was actually parked cars, and is often parked cars, yeah, which is why
people getting out of their cars
in fire,
yeah,
zones, in Los Angeles, if you want to talk about safety, we have these red flag days up in the hills where you're not allowed to park along the curbs when they know that there's going to be a high risk for potential fire. Mm-hmm. So if anything that safety, quote unquote, groups want to go after, it's the parking, mm-hmm, of vehicles on some of these narrow streets that we should not be allowing at any time. If you're worried about the risk of not being able to get through, or emergency, yeah, vehicles not being able to get through. So let's take parking off the streets.
Yeah, I think Ron Lynn is a great disaster reporter in general. He's done a lot of great stuff on earthquakes. And in the article, it does say that there's no evidence suggesting.
Yeah, it literally says it is not clear if this is what contributed, right, to the problem.
But by writing an article about the debate, you kind of justify.
With the headline that now everybody is going to cite in every single public meeting.
A lot of screen grabs.
Every single time this comes up now. And I mean, I'm not going to say that it's not a concern. I mean, I think that's what everybody wants to talk about when we are making changes to our streets. Like, are they safe for all users? Are we making changes? Are we making trade-offs or something like that that's going to help some groups and not help other groups? But there are a lot of ways to do this. And there are a lot of traffic engineers that have spent their whole careers making sure that streets can be safe for not only daily use, but also when 20,000 extra people are trying to use it. But that's not a good example for why we should not make these changes. If you look at the city of Berkeley, which has, there's a great Curbed San Francisco article about this. They had a very bad fire up there in the Oakland Hills that burned a lot of houses, killed a lot of people. And because of that, they explored these non-car evacuation zones. And especially because of earthquakes and landslides and other things that could happen, where it's not about a fire, outrunning a fire. It's about you have to get out of your house because the gas lines are broken and you need to run. I mean, you need to help somebody if they are not able to move. A vehicle needs to get in there to get them out of their house. And we can't have your car with your belongings blocking the street. So they did this program where they are looking at how they could clear and improve some of the things like bike paths and staircases, which we have a lot of here in the LA area, and making sure that those non-car routes are serving as the evacuation zones that need to be there for people in any kind of disaster, which I love. I mean, we need to think of these different paths. We need to think of more options, not less.
Let's return to the LA County Sheriff's election. The LA podcast famously called this race last week in favor of Alex Villanueva. He has expanded his lead since then. Every new dump of votes seems to be at his favor.
Is that the official term?
I think so. That's what Dean Logan said.
I just see them like being dropped. Yeah. Like
he does
by.
Say that, doesn't he?
Incumbent Sheriff Jim McDonald has not conceded
Will
the race.
Will not concede.
Refuses to concede. He wants to keep doing his job. I thought his announcement that he wasn't going to concede on Twitter was very funny because he basically said he's not going to concede. And you know, while there's a disaster going on in Malibu still, and all these other crises in the city, as if conceding in the race would mean that he would have to like actually take off his badge and give it to Alex Villanueva instead of continuing to do his job. And then handing over the reins and like, a, you know, a transition is kind of important for a position like this.
I also want to say that on KFI, Maya Lau posted this on Twitter. I was not listening to KFI. Better things to do with my time. Jim McDonald also said that that his term had been comparable to winning four seasons of championships in some unnamed sport.
Yeah.
And that
Sheriffin.
And that losing would then be like taking the manager out at the end of the game. I don't know what he's talking about. I don't think he'd normally take managers out.
I will say if he had said this during the campaign instead of now after the election is already over, then that would have been reason enough to vote him out. The fact that he thinks that the last 4 years
he thinks of himself as a
championship manager every year. Definitely proves that he does not listen to this show. But Alex Villanueva also this week, we were talking last week about how the Sheriff's Oversight Committee supported the Sheriff's Department no longer working with ICE, getting ICE out of the jails, not handing over prisoners for deportation as soon as they are released. And this was a part of Alex Villanueva's campaign. He got CHRLA, the Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights of Los Angeles, to support him.
Yep.
Because he wanted ICE out of the jails. Since then, and a little bit before the election, but we didn't realize this when mostly me, endorsed him for sheriff. He has said that he does not want to go with the recommendations of the Sheriff's Oversight Committee. He does want to continue working with ICE. He wants to get them out of the physical jail building, but he says that he will escort recently released inmates into ICE vans, essentially, like just off the premises, I guess. I don't understand how this is a fundamental change in policy at all beyond just like very specific spatial arrangements.
It seems like a pretty straightforward gotcha. Like, you know, I just I'm not really in entirely sure how it will play out once he actually is sheriff, as it appears that he will very likely be.
It's called.
That's correct. Yeah, that was an LA podcast call coming straight to you. Yeah.
With the last dump of votes. That's our call.
But yeah, so there was that aspect of it. We're going to walk people into ICE custody. And then he also apparently said that he does not support a cessation in honoring the detention requests of ICE, which is something that, as you mentioned, is a recommendation from the Civilian Oversight Committee. Mm-hmm. So Villanueva, during the course of the campaign, had said that he didn't think that the Civilian Oversight Committee should have the subpoena power that they want, that there is actually a potential ballot measure being put forward by a group called Reform LA Jails, I believe, right, that is intending to give the Civilian Oversight Committee the ability to make legal demands for department records in the sheriff's department.
I believe Jane Fonda has been gathering signatures for this movement in farmers markets around Los Angeles.
Okay, yep. Yeah. And so that is something that's going around. Jim McDonnell also opposed that, although the committee was something that he put in place and pointed to as a part of his own reform platform. Villanueva seems a lot more skeptical of their role, has said that they are an oversight body, but not one that should be tasked with policymaking. True, I guess, to form. And I had a lot of people tell me on Twitter that this was not a flip flop, that he's been saying this stuff all along. Yeah. So, still bad, I would say.
Yeah, no, it's bad. If I'm Churla, if I worked with that organization and endorsed him and walked around knocking on doors for him, and then I hear this shortly after the election, I would be very disappointed as someone who endorsed him. I don't think it was worth voting for McDonnell instead of him, but I think his administration is already off to a very bad start.
So I think that the key thing here is that his statement of why he doesn't think that the Civilian Oversight Committee recommendation is a good one is very Trumpian in its language. But it's also...
Well, let's say how it is Trumpian. He said, because you're going to have rapists that you are releasing back into the population.
Yeah. So here's his exact quote. So the recommendations are to not honor requests for detention.
Right.
His response was, you have very dangerous convicted felons. You're going to have rapists, sexually violent predators. I cannot release them into the public.
But what is it? How does he feel
eligible
about
for deportation? But
how does he feel about citizen rapists, people that have been convicted of crimes and presumably served their time and have been released? Does he not believe they should be released back into the population? Why is it only non-citizen criminals who cannot be returned to the...
Right. So I think that this is kind of weaselly as an answer to the actual recommendation itself, because it's a false choice, basically. That's not what the proposal is. It's not that either you release them to ICE, mm-hmm, who are going to then detain them further, or you release them into
the population.
That's actually not the choice at all. And I should say that the actual recommendations put forth by the committee say they want to bar access. This is, again, according to Maya Lau in an article, they want to bar access to ICE from the sheriff's jails, except where required by law, is actually what it says.
Right.
So, there are inbuilt mechanisms for serious types of offenses already. And I think that there still stands to be some sort of conversation about that level of cooperation, but that kind of protection is already in there.
Right.
So what Villanueva has done is basically just misconstrue, on the one hand, what the actual recommendation is, And on the other hand, what the impact of that would be on Angelinos. So that is extremely disturbing.
I still think even the premise of what he's saying is really disturbing, even if it were true that this is what the commission was suggesting. The idea that people that have committed crimes, you can't in good conscience release them back into the population when their sentence is served. It's kind of a big part of our legal system.
Yeah.
Like when a judge tells you to go to jail for a certain amount of time, when you have served that time, you get out. And the implication there is that people like the at some point you're not deserving of release, even when your sentence is served, from the sheriff of a county of 10 million people. I think that's pretty chilling.
Yeah.
And has anyone tried to get him to talk about this, or can he not really talk about it?
I'm sure that's coming. I think this was one of his first public appearances, I think, since Election Day that he had this conversation.
So this will be part of his victory speech when he finally...
I think we'll hear a lot more about this when the votes are finalized. We probably would have already, except for the fact that McDonald has not yet conceded. So,
man,
more to come.
We should have a Huizar segment at this point. We talk about it every week. There's always something new in the news.
Say it ain't so. Yeah.
Yeah. So
I would go with that.
Say it ain't so. Huizar : say it ain't so. This week, so last week we tipped the possibility that Jose Huizar might be stepping down, that there were a lot of rumors circulating about some bad stuff that had happened in that office. He did not step down. Who did cease their ambitions anyway was his wife, Rochelle Huizar. She said that she is no longer going to be running for city council member in CD14 to replace her husband. I thought her statement was kind of interesting.
Her political consultant statement, I think.
It wasn't a quote.
That's right. It was Derek Humphrey, her political consultant. He had been working on the campaign. He said, "We ask that everyone respect her privacy and the privacy of her children at this time." No reference to...
Like, that's bad. That's the language you really are not going for here, right? I mean...
There's a pretty significant omission in there.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's like at this point, it's very similar to an Anthony Weiner, Huma Abedin situation where it's like her entire she is, whether or not she was actually involved in her husband's wrongdoing, her own career aspirations have at this point been completely torched by her relationship with him.
Right.
So I thought that was an interesting statement as well. But
yeah, no, it's very interesting. Claudia Pasciuta at Reporter Claudia on Twitter, who works for KNX 1070, has been documenting Huizar's presence in city council meetings all week. He did show up for work on Monday, as he promised he was going to do. He was sort of in and out of the council meeting on Monday, and then he did not appear, I believe, for at least one council meeting later in the week. She also did a funny song parody, a mashup, really, of Michael Jackson's Working Day and Night with Jose Huizar's repeated statement that he was, to every question they asked him this week, he just said, "I'm here to show up for work. I'm here to do my job." So that's
a musical week in our city hall.
So that's on her feed. I don't want to steal her work. Anything we see happening there?
I think we talked about last time how the quiet Thanksgiving week, when it seemed like, you know, you could drop a dire climate report and you know, they thought it wouldn't get past the reporters, so would be a great time to resign or make a statement or something.
I don't think it's that they think it's going to get past the reporters. I think it's that they think the reporters are going to report on it and nobody's going to care.
Oh,
the broader public is just tuned out.
So they obviously are too smart. They know that we're too smart for that. So there must be another quiet week coming. Maybe, you know, I'm aiming for Christmas now, where we're gonna...
He might also think that the LA local media market every week is a quiet week to step down from city council.
I will also say, no one will really
notice whenever he does it.
The kind of screw in those plans is that you don't get to choose when you get, for example, perp walked by the FBI.
Like, that's right.
You don't really get to choose.
You do get to choose whether it's before or after your resignation from the council.
That is true.
Whether it's, you know, potentially out of a city council meeting or something like that.
So there's only so much you can do.
Not that we're saying that is definitely going to happen. But
it's not looking good, though.
It is very weird that his office refuses to say a single word about this, and it's still not out there in any reports what he is being investigated for by the FBI. This is someone who is still serving a city council member who was raided in his home and office by the FBI, and we still don't know what for.
Is that common for the FBI not to, I guess that is, for them not to say what they're looking for?
I think if there are sealed indictment or whatever.
Yeah, if there are other targets, they don't want to tip off.
Right, they don't want anybody else to burn their hard drives.
Right. But often,
before the dogs get to it.
Before the dogs sniff them out.
In the national media, when like Paul Manafort or whatever gets his the door kicked in, we hear what the investigation is circulating. We at least have some idea what's going on. Here, there's nothing out there. It's total silence. Some people think it's connected to him being sued by former aides, but it doesn't. It seems very possible that it has nothing to do with that, even likely.
I think we've said on here that the FBI investigation predates even the Francine Godoy lawsuit from 2013. So
right,
and there was another detail I think that was tellingly included in the original reporting of the FBI raid that there was a box labeled fundraising removed from Huizar's house. So very likely whatever they're looking at is financial in nature.
Yeah.
We don't have more information than that right now, obviously, but it is undoubtedly very serious.
Right. But for the people who think like, oh, it's because, you know, it was just in the news that he was accused of mistreating his, you know, like gender discrimination and things like that among his aides. The FBI doesn't do this kind of thing.
No, that's not an FBI investigation.
They don't get involved for that kind of thing.
But who doesn't have a box in their office labeled fundraising?
I have one that's empty just in case I ever raise funds for something. I need space for it.
Yeah, I got to put the money somewhere.
So anyway, aside from his return, his not-so-triumphant return to city council this past week, the announcement by Rochelle Huizar that she is no longer seeking CD14's council seat when her husband is termed out in 2020 leaves this vacancy, this void in terms of who's going to run to replace him. David Zonizer and Emily Alpert Reyes of the LA Times, who cover City Hall, they put forth a couple of heavy hitters. In their article, Wendy Carrillo, who represents 8051, that is the assembly district covering historic Filipino town, Echo Park, Northeast LA, Chinatown. Miguel Santiago, who's in Assembly District 53.
Mm-hmm. And we've mentioned as a, I think both of them we've mentioned.
As we've talked about as candidates. They also brought up Kevin De Leon. So they reached out to all three of those former legislator in Kevin De Leon's case. So of those, Miguel Santiago did not comment. Wendy Carrillo said basically people have told her that she should look at running for this seat.
Uh-huh. Ooh, that's a good
Worth
one.
Mentioning that's is that Wendy one. Carrillo used to work for Jose Huizar, and both of the aides who are now suing Jose Huizar for discrimination work in Wendy Carrillo's office.
Yeah, that was Huizar basically just popped in. But yeah, no, so that is actually true. So those aides do work in Carrillo's office. She got her start in politics working with Jose Huizar. So, I mean, not to bandy about rumors, but it is definitely safe to say that she is familiar with him. He endorsed her for her special election, which she won last year for the assembly seat. And she is undoubtedly familiar with his professional conduct, which it seems like a lot of women who work for him have problems with. I think that's safe to say. Miguel Santiago, we don't really know that much about his interest in this seat at this point, other than to say that he has a relatively powerful position in the assembly. this is very much his this overlapping district with him. I'm not sure whether it could tempt him to leave the communications committee, which he chairs in the assembly currently. He got into some hot water earlier this year when he tried to strip the net neutrality bill that was going through the legislature. That's his big, I would say, the thing people most likely know him from. Kevin DeLeon is kind of a wild card here. His staff openly admitted that he is looking for his next opportunity after getting beaten, not as badly as people expected in the statewide race, but getting beaten by a margin of 10 or 11 points by Dianne Feinstein in the senator's race.
But he doesn't have the advantage in CD14 of millions of Republicans voting for him.
That is
because
true.
They hate Dianne Feinstein so much.
That is true. And I think we remarked during the primary that he did not win his own district in the primary.
No, he did not.
Against Dianne Feinstein. So who knows if the local support is there. Also, being one of 15 council members in LA is undoubtedly a major come down from being the head of the state senate.
And if you eventually want to be mayor,
it's
like you got to do something. And I think he wants to
kill time.
Yeah, I think he wants to use the name recognition. Even though he didn't win his own district, he got a lot more. He got a lot better known from running for senator.
I would
say
so.
Would it be like "Come on, De Leon"?
Instead of oh yeah, he needs a song.
You start. You get out the pen and paper and start writing.
It's all up here. It's all up here.
thank you for listening to LA Podcast. Should we tip show notes? Are we allowed to? Is it safe to do that?
Yes, those will be up.
Scott is putting up show notes on lawebsite.net. So any article we've mentioned in this episode, any song that's on YouTube, you can listen to it there.
Yeah, Hayes is right. The past couple of weeks, I've made this promise I was going to do it. I made the mistake of telling a guest we were going to do it. Then I told you guys we were going to do it.
But you seem very emphatic this week. And there's no rush. There's no pressure. And even if we're tipping it now and people go to LAwebsite.net and it's not there, please, everyone, be understanding.
Just go to Scott's blog and
check
pretend
on my blog.
That
this is a free service. There's no pressure on Scott to do this. But if he does, that's great. We'll be back next week. Bye.